Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Afterword. I'm Dave Tisch. So I've got a question for you, loyal listeners out there in Afterword land. What is your favorite Pixar film out of all of them? I should probably read you a list of all the Pixar films. That would take too long. Google it. You have the phone. You've got the internet right there in your pocket. Just Google it. Oh, wait. I asked my wife this question and she's like, The Little Mermaid. I'm like, woman, that's not a Pixar film. That's a Disney film. My wife loves The Little Mermaid almost inexplicably so much. Sometimes when I'm just heading to Best Buy, she'll just yell out, you've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty. Side note, you know the main song from that film, Part of Your World? There's a lyric where Ariel says, you know, walking around on that, what's that word again? Feet. She forgets the word feet, which is kind of like humans forgetting the word wings. I mean, yeah, I don't live in the sky like the birds, but I know what a bird is and I know what wings are. I'm not going to forget that word. It's kind of weird. It's a little nitpick. Anyway, back to Pixar. What is your favorite all-time Pixar film? I think I've got a three-way tie in my own heart and head. And again, these are not the right. There's no wrong answers here. There is. The Good Dinosaur is a wrong answer. That movie sucked. But everything else, that's fair game. I can understand how you would love almost every other Pixar film. So I think my three, I'm going to go old school. I'm kind of an old school guy. Toy Story, of course, with Buzz Lightyear and Woody, one of the great friendships in cinema history. Toy Story 1 and 2, awesome. Kind of one continuous story in some ways, I would argue. Toy Story 3 was animated trauma. I have no idea how that's a kid's movie. Gave everyone in our family nightmares for weeks. You remember that scene where they're like on the trash compactor and they're about to be incinerated? And you're like, oh, I did not realize I was going to be contemplating the imminent death of myself and all my loved ones in an animated film. And on a list of all-time movie villains that are cruel, heartless, soulless, and terrifying, it's like Darth Vader, Hannibal Lecter, the shark from Jaws, and Lotso the Bear. The writers of Toy Story 3 actually, at the end of that film, had Lotso tied to the front of a garbage truck, circling ad infinitum in his own personal torment and hell. Actually, if you know anything about this, the Greek word for hell is the word Gehenna, and Gehenna was actually a place. It was a trash dump outside of Jerusalem. The writers of Toy Story are making a subtle nod, I think, that Lotso is in hell. How is this a children's movie, people? But anyway. So yeah, back to Pixar. I also love the film Monsters, Inc. My wife and I saw that when she was actually pregnant with my daughter, JL. That film kind of gave me an imagination for what it might be like to be a dad of a girl, you know? And so...
Pooh? Kitty!
Kitty! And so that just... And one year as a teacher, I went as Sully for Halloween, and it was a big hit. But enough about that. You know, even though it's not one of my favorite Pixar films, one of the most interesting and thought-provoking that still kind of stays with me today is a film that was released in 2015, almost 10 years ago, which is hard to believe. It was called Inside Out, and it follows the inner workings of the mind of a young girl named Riley who has to, like, react to and adapt to her family's relocation. And if you know anything about the film, there's like this control panel for Riley. It's kind of like the control center or the command deck of this Starship Enterprise. And there's these five characters that kind of take turns kind of controlling Riley. And there are five core emotions, anger and disgust and fear and sadness. And of course, the leader of all of them is joy. And I often think about this. I want in my own life for joy to be at the control panel of my life and my heart more often than it is. Of course, one of the central lessons of this film is that sometimes you can have multiple emotions going on at the same time. You can have sadness and joy commingling together. Joy can actually undergird everything, actually, if you think about it. And so that's what I want. I want joy to tinge everything. And not joy meaning general happiness, but as kind of Dallas Willard defines it, as a deep, pervasive sense of well-being, that God is good and that He is with me. That's what I want. That's what I want to undergird my life. And that's what we're here to talk about. We are in a brand new sermon series called Philippians, This is Living, in which we're going to be examining the book of Philippians that Paul writes. And one of the center themes of this book is how to have joy, how to have life, how to experience joy and life to the full. It's incredible because in this book, Paul is writing this letter to the church at Philippi from jail in Rome, where he's facing possible execution. And he still says, I am able to have joy even in the middle of these circumstances. If it's possible to have joy in the middle of a Roman prison, then that means it is possible to have joy anywhere in the world under any circumstances for anyone. And I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really believe this. I kind of believe to my core that joy is really only possible when things are going up and to the right, when things are going really well. That's when joy can happen. But that's not what Paul says. So we're here to dive in and examine that. I've got Jay Kim with me. We're going to look at the overall theme of the book of Philippians, the overall kind of outline of the message series. And then we're going to talk about Paul's first bit of advice in the opening chapter of Philippians about how to have joy and the incredible advice, the counterintuitive advice that Paul gives, that joy is found when you find the right master to serve. Yeah, really shocking. So wait, I'm sorry, what? I'm supposed to become a servant to some master? Paul's like, no, you already are a servant to a master. You just got to pick the right one. And so I've got Jay Kim here. And so we're going to dive into that on this week's episode of The Afterword. Welcome to The Afterword, here with Jay Kim. Jay.
Hey, man.
So, I want to dive into this.
Yes.
You're probably tired of talking about it.
Talking about what?
About Fight Club. Oh. We're going to break the rules of Fight Club.
By talking about Fight Club.
We're going to talk about Fight Club. That's what we're going to do.
So good.
It's interesting. So, the reason why is, yeah, we talked about it, but I did a little bit of a deep dive.
Yeah.
And the movie wasn't that big in 1999. It was kind of right. A cult classic, but it was small. It was not a giant commercial success.
Yeah,
but
surprising.
It has become kind of a seminal piece of the late 90s.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know if you know this, but the movie premiered in 1999 on September 11th.
Oh, what?
Yeah, at a film festival.
Yeah, yeah.
2 years later.
Yeah.
And some of the themes in the movie,
well, the closing scene, and
yes,
yeah,
the closing
crazy.
Scene with,
oh my goodness,
all the buildings falling,
yeah,
right,
wow.
And the centers of capitalism,
oh,
and
geez.
The angst of young men,
yeah,
who feel disaffected,
mm-hmm.
Right, this is kind of what fed into 9/11 and the general discontent,
wow.
Of in general young men looking for meaning and purpose and
yeah.
Angry, I would say angry
at, right.
You know, Tyler Durden is a guide, a spiritual guide of sorts. It just happens
yeah.
to be a destructive spiritual guide.
Yeah, yeah.
So
wow.
I was kind of struck by that. Just how many people I think probably feel that angst of,
yep.
There has got to be more than life. There are enemies that are preventing me from, you know, feeling fulfillment.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you though, but it seems to have, I wonder if it's been tempered or heightened. In our modern world. And, you know, you've done a lot of thinking about this. I was thinking that one of the things that they say often in terms of, we're talking about Philippians and
yep.
joy.
Yeah.
The whole letter's about joy. Paul uses the word joy or rejoice like 17 times in mm-hmm. this tiny book. My question is, if comparison is the thief of joy, and they say that it is, then how does Instagram and social media, it seems like that would absolutely tie into people's feeling of discontentedness.
Yeah.
Because it would steal their joy. Is that one part? Is that a big part? Is that the biggest part? Is there other parts? How have the themes of Fight Club and just the sense, the modern malaise of, I want more out of life. There has to be more. I'm not feeling a
yeah.
deep, settled sense of joy. I wonder how that's affecting.
I mean, it certainly seems like social media is a significant part, if not, you know, a primary part of our lack of joy and a primary sort of engine behind comparison culture. Not for everybody, but for many people, probably for most people. I think that that's true. And I, you know, it's been written about extensively. I think a lot of people know it. So the awareness is not even really the thing anymore. I think most people are aware of what social media is doing to them and to their levels of joy. I think it's really about what we do with that awareness. You know, can we, willpower is not enough. This is something we've talked about before. So like, what are the practices and habits,
the structures of
and
our
disciplines?
Lives,
yeah. Yeah. You know, the regula or the rules of life that we will sort of put in place to, you know, put ourselves in position to experience deep joy without constantly having to fight against the comparison sort of beast that consumes us, not just on social media. I think it happens in many ways, but certainly social media is a big part of that for sure.
It was interesting. Yes, all those things. It's just a reminder. Yeah, I love what you said. It's not just about knowing it. It's about what are we going to do about that?
Yeah.
I wonder if Paul could write a letter to the church in San Jose about joy, what he would say. He'd something to probably put away some of those, your phone. One of the other things that I thought about, though, in relation to Fight Club is Fight Club is kind of Tyler's main idea. One of his main ideas is that, like, the system is stacked against you. It's anger at the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving back from Baylor, Texas, Baylor University in Texas, all the way back to San Jose with my son. And we stopped in Albuquerque. It was like 11 hours away or whatever it was. And in Albuquerque, the clerk at our hotel, he had this little badge that said he was from LA. I said, oh, you're from LA? And he was like, yeah, I moved out here because there's no chance I could ever, with a meaningful career, buy anything. I'm just priced out in LA.
Yeah.
There's just no way for me to do it. So I moved to Albuquerque where things are cheaper. There's a sense in which even in California, it's like there's a sense of the system. And I'm wondering if that the churn of the Bay Area, plus the housing market, plus the cost of living, plus jobs, plus all that, also creates a sense of comparison or joy and makes people have a hard time experiencing settled like joy as well.
Yeah.
Or if that's too concrete, because you see these kind of flight numbers of people trying to move out of the area. I wonder if that was part of...
Yeah, I'm sure it's lots of things. You know, it's the pace of life here, which is dictated by the cost of living here. You have to move fast and accomplish much. You have to keep climbing whatever ladder you're climbing. Otherwise, how can you possibly survive? Yeah, I mean, I think it's simple and it's complex. It's simple in that any culture that's just forcing you to constantly go up and to the right just to survive, you know, up and to the right isn't really up and to the right here. Up and to the right is just
baseline.
Yeah, it's baseline. So, yeah, I think it's all of that stuff for sure. It's just, it's really hard to live here. It's hard to survive here, let alone thrive here. So then our energies and our focus and our attention gets really fixated on, you know, working so hard just to make it. And that coupled with comparison, it's like, oh, this coworker or that person or this friend or whatever, they're doing X, Y, and Z, and I'm not. Yeah, I just think it's all sort of the formulas. Yeah, you know, it's a lot.
So. Okay, before we get to the antidote, which I think Paul is giving us, I wanted to say, so those are some of the problems unique to the Bay Area, which I do think are tension points that we have to like think through. But there's something else, and I sent this to you, and you're like, yeah, I already saw that. I love it. It was the rise of the dopamine culture.
Yeah.
And let me try to explain this to folks. The idea is that we're moving from like a slow traditional culture to a fast modern culture to an even faster dopamine culture. Dopamine's the chemical in the brain. It's a little like a pleasure center.
Mm-hmm.
It's like fast hits. And I was thinking about this, like it used to be you play a sport and you kick like a winning goal or you hit a home run and you'd get a joy center, right? Oh, mm-hmm. Yay. And then that changed to I'm going to watch a sport and watch my team win. And that's going to create a hit of, and now it's, I'm going to gamble on a sport. And then my fantasy football and my gambling. And so it's faster and faster. Or even like images. You used to go to a gallery and look at beautiful paintings or photographs on the wall. And then we would like view them like digitally on our phone. We could see with digital cameras. And now it's like little Instagram. You just scroll through them. Or even stuff like music. I remember when I was a kid, Michael Jackson's Thriller album, yeah. opening it up and seeing the tiger and, yeah. you know, seeing all the music liner notes. And then you like listen to it. And then it goes to you, iTunes. You could buy little individual songs. And now it's like little tiny clips on TikTok.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of, I feel like that's more of a symptom of people trying to grab life by the horns and carpe the heck out of this DM to get some sort of like meaning or, you know, joy yeah. out of life. Yeah. And it's like, it mimics joy, but it's not really joy. So it's like, it feels like that's what our culture is trying to do. It's trying to find, trying to find meaning. It's just going to wells that aren't good. Is that how you see it, or do you see it differently?
Yeah, I mean, I can see that a little bit. I think what you're talking about and what that chart shows, it's fascinating. I would encourage anyone to go find. I saw it on Twitter, so I don't know where you would go to find it, but maybe we could post it.
Yeah, Rise of Dopamine Culture. Just go and Google that. You'll find the articles on it.
I mean, I think that that chart has more to do with probably the increasingly frenetic pace at which we seek joy, but I don't necessarily think going backwards on the chart, I don't think slowing down is the path to joy. So what I mean by that is, like, sure, scrolling quickly through Instagram and looking at filtered images is not nearly the sort of deep, meaningful, rich experience that walking slowly through a museum gallery is. They're very different things. And that is in part a result of dopamine culture. But I also don't think walking slowly and thoughtfully through a museum is the source of joy. So I don't know that I personally would correlate the two.
Oh, interesting.
I think that the dopamine culture is reflecting more on maybe the frenzy and the pace at which we seek joy, not necessarily, you know, a sort of deterioration of, like, you know, the sources of joy. I actually think, biblically speaking, what Paul makes really clear is, like, joy is, it can be a foundational truth that sort of undergirds no matter what pace of life you feel, or, you know, how much your life is moving up and to the right or down and to the left or whatever, you know, like, there's a way in which you can experience real joy in the midst of all of that.
Do you have a definition in your head of what the word joy means? If you're trying to describe the, because it's a spiritual fruit, Paul lists it as like an attribute of what happens. Do you have a definition for joy when you think about it? When you if you were to describe it to someone?
Yeah, I mean, I'm paraphrasing Dallas Willard here, but he would describe joy as like a pervasive sense of goodness and safety and security and well-being in the goodness of God. And I think that makes sense to me. I think that's joy.
So a deep, settled sense that God knows me, sees me, and is at work. And even if I can't necessarily see or understand everything, that something's happening, Aslan's on the move, winter is melting, spring is coming, right? That kind of set, and he knows me, right?
Yep.
Right. Now, is that different? Would you say it's different than the word happiness? Just how we define it?
No, I mean, it depends on what we mean by happiness. Like, words have elasticity. In the New Testament, the word for blessed is probably best translated into the English word happy. So there is kind of a misnomer out there. It's like, God wants to give you joy, not happiness. It's like, well, yes, but I don't know.
If happy's, like, a dopamine hit, then maybe no.
Right.
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 Yeah.
Some of it too, I think, is the thing we're chasing. It's like, listen, when you have like deep joy because of, you know, a deep, meaningful experience of God, even in the midst of a troubling season of your life, your brain does release the dopamine pleasure chemical. Like, that does happen. Even so, like, in a weird way, I don't know. I think sometimes we oversimplify the whole thing. But yeah, I guess generally I would say joy is very different than the cultural renderings of happiness, which is a chasing after the feeling. But I think the feeling does come on the far side of like real joy. You know, I think there can be experiences of like sort of this exhilarating, euphoric, oh my gosh, God is really good.
So,
and he's really with me, you know, can have that even in the midst of hardship, I think.
Yeah. It is fascinating. If you were to explain happiness, would you say that a lot of our modern culture is chasing after the feeling of joy or the effects of joy? And what Paul is trying to get us to focus on is the source of joy.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, I think so.
Which leads us to our 8-week series, which I love because we're going to be basically talking about how to find joy.
How to find life.
Life.
Not just joy.
Life and joy together. Yeah. You could say that if you find life and life overflowing, it will lead to a lasting, pervasive.
Yeah, I just think it leads to more than that. I think it leads to more than joy. I mean, there's a danger in just chasing joy, too. It's a way to, like, spiritualize, you know, self. It's a way to spiritualize sort of, like, therapeutic culture.
What makes me feel good kind of feel?
Yeah, if you take it too far. You know, there's no denying that. I mean, Paul talks about joy a lot in Philippians, but I think what he's really talking about is like living. I think the crux of the whole letter is for me to live as Christ and to die as gain. I think that's the crux. So that's what we're trying to get after. I'll just say it point blank. It will not always feel good. It does not always feel good to follow Jesus. Like sometimes joy is a sort of, you know, place of like determined, gritty faith. Like it's not these euphoric feelings. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not.
Right.
But you'll feel alive
the
whole time, is my sense.
But Paul opens up, and we talked about this in our teaching. Paul opens up by saying, I pray for you all the time with joy.
Yeah.
Whether I'm in chains or free.
Yeah.
And when he's writing this, he's in chains.
Yeah.
Which is not the feeling I would say I would get if I were in a Roman prison, right, imprisoned by Romans, knowing what Romans do to Jesus.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know where this heads.
Yeah.
When you go after Caesar and his supremacy and you're preaching or talking about that in the public square, I know what Romans do to those kind of threats. I would not have said joy. Paul says this, that which seems to indicate joy is possible to anyone, anywhere, at any time.
Yes.
Which is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But it can't, that means we have to switch our definition of joy.
Yeah.
Because it can't be, this feels good.
Yeah.
But he, even as he goes on, and we'll get to this in later weeks, he's like, man, my jailers, they're starting to talk. I see God moving.
Yep.
It's going to be crazy. And he's like, they might let me out. They might kill me.
Yeah.
And then he does this kind of like, it's like a whatever.
Yeah.
Paul does a whatever when it comes to death.
Yeah.
Which is mind blowing.
Yeah.
That's mind blowing. So I think, but then he also talks in, and we talked about this in Romans too, that what it means to live is to be a servant of the right king.
Yeah.
And he feels that he is, in his core, a servant to the right king, and that gives him a pervasive identity shifting safety and settledness, I would say, even in the midst of swirling, chaotic, are they even going to kill me?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which is, that's the thing I think Paul's trying to get everyone to.
Because
it's like, well, if I can do it here, if it's possible in these circumstances, it must be possible anywhere.
Right, right.
Yeah. But let's talk about that. So the first lesson this week, and Paul kind of organizes Philippians around seven kind of lessons, mini essays, mini lessons. And then it's kind of centered around this Christ poem, which you're going to talk about on week four, Ruth, and you're going to talk about. But the first lesson is kind of like who you serve matters, or who you're a slave to matters. Mm. And he says it's better to be a servant to the right, being a servant to the right kind of king is the source of life and joy.
Yeah.
And that is not something that I think that a lot of people think about. We don't like to think of ourselves as servants or slaves to anyone. Mm. So that's a countercultural idea.
Yeah.
You know, and so How does being a servant to the right thing unlock life or joy? Now I'm like, man, should I use the word life or joy, or should it be interchangeable? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So how is being how does being a servant to the right king unlock life and joy?
Well, I mean, I said it on Sunday at Saratoga. Everyone's a slave to something, and everyone's free to everything else. You know, like in Romans, Paul makes it pretty clear. We read it on Sunday. It's like, hey, you were once a slave to sin and free from righteousness.
Yeah.
It's like, that's true. It's like everyone's a slave and everyone's free. Everyone. Every person on the planet ever. So that's really what it is. I think we have to ask the question, this thing I'm enslaved to, and the way we recognize what we're enslaved to is like what captivates our heart, mind, our imagination, our time, energy, resources, money, thoughts, you know, all those things. The source of our greatest desire and longing, or the target of our greatest desires and longings. Like, that's our Lord. And we have to ask honest questions about where enslavement to that thing or that idea or desire, where it really leads us. Like, what do we think it'll do, and what will it actually do?
Yeah.
You know? And in what ways will it disappoint us? You know? So yeah, I think that's what it is. I mean, Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life, you know, through whom we get to the Father, and no one else gets us there. You know, what's clear is, like, at least my best understanding of the scriptures is that he is the one Lord that can lead us to real joy, to life that is truly life. So we enslave ourselves to him, and that's where we head. And everything else falls short of that, you know? And so I think that's a helpful reminder for me. It's like, we're all slaves to something, and we're all living in total freedom from all other things except the thing we're slaves to. And so we've got to decide, you know, who or what we will enslave ourselves to.
I love this quote by Dallas Willard. We're just going to quote Dallas Willard this entire podcast, I guess. He says, it's one of the major transitions of life to recognize who has taught us, who has mastered us, and then to evaluate the results in us of their teaching.
Yeah.
This is a harrowing task, and sometimes we just can't face it. Mm. But it can also open the door to choose other masters, possibly better masters,
and
one master above all.
Yeah, that's good.
Which is, I think this is what Paul is saying in Romans and Philippians, is evaluate your master. Who is your master? And I love how Paul says in Romans, when you were a slave to sin, you were totally free from righteousness. Like, you had, that wasn't even on your radar. And for those of us who have lived without Jesus, like, I think about my college days, it's like this white hot cheeks of shame, you know? It's like, man, it's nothing but regret and ick, you know?
Yep.
And I think people kind of know and understand that. And Paul is saying it's that's not really freedom. It also reminds me of, like, modern definition of freedom from, like, Sigmund Freud. He says, freedom is freedom to act as I am acting, to arrange my life as seems right to me and to me alone.
Right.
Which is just, it feels like that's kind of the modern... That I would say that most people are probably slaves to that.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I think is my default setting on it, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
That's my default setting. Let me ask you a question. How do you help people identify if they're, most people are like, I'm absolutely a slave to, you know, I love to be a slave to Jesus. But how do you know when that, your desire to be a slave to Jesus is misaligned with the way that you're living your life, or that maybe you've got another master kind of that, you're maybe not fooling yourself is too strong of a term, but maybe that you've got these other masters that are actually vying for your attention, and Jesus might not be, you know, yours. How do you help people identify that?
Yeah, I mean, it's different than, like, you know, I mean, I think we vacillate all the time. So I just think it's a day by day, moment by moment realignment we need to make.
So
it's not as
so
simple
almost
as
like a car that's going kind of, you kind of got to keep.
Yeah, the language is tricky because you think about, like, an indentured servant, and they just are for decades or whatever.
Right, right.
That, but that's not how it works in a complex human being. Andy Crouch says that human beings are, you know, heart, soul, mind, strength complexes made for love. And if you continue reading his thoughts there, what he means is like our heart, souls, mind, and our strength gets leveraged and tempted in all sorts of directions all the time because we're seeking love. And often we seek love in the wrong places, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places, like the song is true. So we enslave ourselves sometimes moment by moment to Christ or away from Christ. And I think it's just about, you know, sometimes we want to like, how do I know? And then we think like, oh yeah, I'm enslaved to Christ. So now I just kind of move on about my day. But the reality is we make that choice with every choice, with every decision, every action, every motivation, every, you know, it's about living the life of willingly and with determination, recalibrating when we become misaligned.
Right.
And that's just, it's going to be the case for the rest of our lives because we're sinful, broken humans. Right. And there are other masters who, you know, are vying for our allegiance all the time. So I think it's about living, you know, and again, like we said it on Sunday, but it's about inviting God by his Spirit to complete the work in us that we can't complete on our own.
Yeah.
And just asking him every moment, like, Lord, realign my heart to my true master, you, you know?
I think that verse might be one of the more encouraging in all Scripture, that God would complete the good work which he has begun in you. That is so, I think, so hope-filled. The idea that God doesn't give up on us. Because I think a lot of people would say, you know, and I hear this a lot, especially from like, you know, college kids that, you know, I hang around with now because my son's in college. It's just like, man, I made that mistake for the 50th time. Mm-hmm. I'm not even, I wonder if God even thinks that I'm, you know, I wonder if he's given up on me or more. I don't even know if I'm really, I guess I'm not really a Christian, because if I were a Christian, I wouldn't do that thing 50 times in a row. And it's like, no, you're being a bad Christian, I suppose, but that doesn't mean you're not his. You know, he's not going to give up on you. And I think that sense that God's not going to give up on us actually instills us with more hope to keep going.
Yeah.
And that's, which I find it emboldening, because it's like he doesn't turn his love off. You know, he could.
Right.
And actually, frankly, he might even should, but he doesn't. That's not who he is. And I think that really can be a source of real encouragement for folks to keep going and keep plotting.
Yep.
And keep, like you said, you know, making those daily alignments.
Yeah.
So now where do we go from here in terms of what are your general hopes for the general series? You chose this in particular. Why Philippians? Is it just because joy and life are just central themes? Is it because the tone is so beautiful? And the tone really is like a proud parent encouraging their kid to keep going into maturity and Christlikeness. It really does feel, I think you called it a friendship letter, actually. I didn't. Is it that? Did you choose it because it's like so upbeat and like that? And you're hoping to infuse some.
Yeah, it's all those things. I mean, at Lisa Saratoga also talked about the background of Philippi. Paul, in the midst of this friendship letter, is writing very strongly, urging these Christians to remember that their primary allegiance is to Jesus and not to an empire. We're in an election year. You know, I said on Sunday, I'm really grateful to be a citizen of this country and grateful for the many sacrifices of men and women who've forged the way for us to live with all the various benefits we have as Americans. But if you're a follower of Jesus, your primary allegiance is not to a national flag. Your savior doesn't live in the White House for 4 years. You know, our allegiance is to Christ. So there's a lot of that as we prepare for the election, what will be a very tense election season, I'm sure, potentially divisive. So there's some of that. But ultimately, yeah, I think my hope is that we would just capture a vision for a way to like really live, you know, and experience joy, like you said, and feel like we're not just like breathing, we're actually living, you know, and I think that's something we all want. And this letter offers us a path in that direction. So that's my hope. You know,
real quick, devotionally, would you recommend people just kind of focus week by week on the passage or like kind of read the whole letter?
It's a short letter, so I think you could read the whole letter, just immerse yourself in it probably like every week, you know.
Just, so you would recommend that, just reading the whole letter every week?
Well, I don't know. I would recommend whatever is most helpful to you.
Okay.
But that's what I do. Yeah, I just try to read the whole letter.
Because it is pretty short.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, there it is. Philippians part one. There it is. And next week, we're going to talk about if this week is countercultural, joy and life are found in being a servant to the right master, then next week is even more shocking.
Yeah.
Paul says, hey, you know what? Death. Whatever.
Right.
It's better to die.
Right.
Like, what?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Crazy.
So we're going to continue on in these, countercultural, counterintuitive spiritual lessons that I love. And I love how Paul, it's not like Paul's philosophy. He's like, this is actually who Jesus is.
Yeah.
So this is rooted in the Savior, the Messiah, the Lord. So we're just trying to find our story in his character, in his life, which is, that's even more compelling.
Well, yeah.
Well, so we'll see you next week.
Cool.
All right. Thanks guys. Just want to say thanks to J. Kim for stopping by. Join me next week when David Kim is in the studio and the two Davids take on Paul's next bit of advice, which is even more shocking. He says that true joy is found in, are you ready for it? Suffering and death. Okay, well, that's not going to be fun to talk about. Actually, it's going to be very interesting. We're going to talk about how joy can come from suffering and death. And that's next week on The Afterword.